An obscure, uneducated fisherman became one of the world's most renowned individuals. The story of his rise to fame is one of the most unusual on record. I'll be back in a moment with the amazing facts. Hello, this is Joe Cruz in the Amazing Facts broadcast, facts which affect you. I read recently of a business executive who made contact with people daily through interviews in his office. This man demanded from the company a long office with his desk located at the very end of the room opposite the door that came in. As people walked in to talk with him, he looked them over and sized them up mentally before beginning the interview. As they walked across the room and took their seat, he had already judged them and made his decision. Now, we do so quickly judge and classify people by their looks, their walk, and their attitudes. Today, we want to think about the looks of Jesus. After all, he sees the same people that we do. But what does he think of them? How does he judge individuals? I'm thankful to say that he doesn't do it in the same way we do. In Ephesians, Paul writes that Christ does things according to the riches of his grace or his glory. And friends, the riches of Christ can change things around considerably. God looks on the heart and not merely on the outward appearance. In 1 Corinthians 1:27 we read, "But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty." Now, how true that text is, friends. Just think about the man that God used to shape the world and to shake the world. I don't understand why he selected his disciples as he did. He passed by the great scholars of his day and by the great rabbinical schools and went down to the seashore to find fishermen. I don't understand how he could have seen any promise at all in those lowly men who were chosen to be his disciples. I mean, after all, his message was to be a worldwide message. It was to reach men in all languages of the earth. Why didn't he select those scholars in the Greek and Hebrew languages and who were linguistically inclined? But he passed all of them by and called those men from the very lowest levels of society. I can imagine one morning in the little fishing village of Bethsaida, the fishermen had come back from their nightly toil and were engaged in the work of mending nets. And among those who toiled that morning was a hard-headed, brawny individual who never dreamed that he was living in the day that would change his entire life. Perhaps he was humming some village folk song that day as he mended his nets and took care of his catch, not realizing that something would happen to him that day that would bring his name at last upon the lips of millions of people. He was just an obscure fisherman when Jesus passed by and looked at him. Now listen, what did Christ see that day? Not the man that Peter was, but the man he might become by the grace of God. He saw the real fisherman underneath who would stand up to thunder forth the gospel and bring thousands down to the cross of Jesus. He saw not the smelly nets of that crude seaman, but looked at what was underneath. Other people were repulsed by this diamond in the rough. But Jesus saw the possibility of development in the life of this impulsive fisherman. And by the way, friends, that's the reason a lot of us are not out there still dragging the old smelly nets of sin around with us. Jesus passed by one day and looked at us and loved us. And he didn't see as others did either. He saw the glorious possibilities of what we might become. Oh, the riches of his grace. I wish we could know the full story of Peter. First of all, I wonder why he was so willing to follow immediately. There must have been something strangely irresistible and compelling about that Galilean who called him to be a disciple. When he said, "Follow me," Peter gladly laid down his expensive nets and equipment to become an itinerant disciple of Christ. And then those months and years passed by as Peter's life was shaped up into a masterpiece of character. It took a long time, of course, because the man was very arrogant and impulsive. I'm reminded of the time Michelangelo walked down the streets of Rome and saw a piece of cracked marble lying in a corner. It had been thrown away, apparently, by some erstwhile sculptor, but Michelangelo looked at it and saw something in that old cold stone. He called for his assistants to come, who hauled it into his studio. He began to work on it with chisel and mallet. Deeper and deeper into the night, he continued his work, week after week, month after month. Finally, his statue was finished. A statue of David, that masterpiece that stood for many years in the Basilica of St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. Many people believe that it was the most perfect piece of sculpture that's ever been produced. The only thing it lacks is life itself. Well, that's what Jesus saw in Peter as he looked at him that day in Bethsaida. And it took a lot of pounding, a lot of hammering to remove all the selfishness, the pride, the vainglory. It took many blows, for example, like the night of the Transfiguration and the night when he saw Jesus walking on the sea and the denial by the fireside. But slowly, slowly, Christ carved a masterpiece out of the rough material of the big fisherman. Friends, I'm glad Jesus saw me one day when he came looking for me. Aren't you happy that he didn't pass you by? He could see something promising, something beautiful, even the most ugly. When God wanted to shake the world, what did he look for? Whom did he choose? Well, he took a black-eyed gypsy boy in England. He took a shoe salesman in Chicago by the name of Moody. And in his own day, besides Peter, he selected those sons of thunder to be his disciples. Those two men, James and John, you remember, were very angry, vengeful fellows. That's where they got their nickname. They would lose their temper at the drop of a hat. And yet Jesus called them to be his disciples. They had been given that name, by the way, by Christ himself because of their terrible wrath. But other people might have laughed about it, but Jesus saw what grace could accomplish in the lives of those men when he chose them to be his disciples. And then there's the time Jesus went walking down into the Bowery section of wicked old New York City. And amidst all the vice and corruption, amidst the drunken derelicts of the street, Jesus saw one who was a bit worse than most of the others. That drunken piece of humanity in the gutter. And he said, "Follow me." And Sam Hadley got up from that gutter and answered the call of the Savior and became one of the great preachers of his time. Thousands of people were led to the cross through the preaching of that man who had been raised up from the most hopeless position. No one believed it possible, but it did happen. And that's why I like to preach about the grace of Jesus, friends. It's free, and it's for everybody to experience. God has taken the worst and made the best out of it. You know, grace is really the power of God, the miracle-working power. It's not a theory or a dream or a dead hope. It takes power to hew a stone block into the image of a man. But it takes even more power to form a man into the image of Christ. In 1 Corinthians 15:10, we read these words of Paul, "But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace which was bestowed upon me was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me." You know, Paul seemed to appreciate God's grace more than any other person who wrote in the Scriptures. Jesus looked one day and saw that man rushing up to Damascus with orders to kill all the saints. And what did he see when he looked at Paul or Saul on his way to Damascus? Did he see the religious fanatic, friends? The Pharisee bigot? Oh, no. He saw an apostle of love and power. He saw what would happen to Saul after the encounter on the road to that Syrian city. And from the moment of his conversion, Saul was never the same. If ever I've seen a man who knew how to be thankful for salvation, that man was Paul. Later on, he was shipwrecked, imprisoned. But no matter, he was still faithful and courageous. You know why? Because he had tasted of the grace of God. Suppose you should ask Paul about that grace, if he could be right here today, and ask him, "What is it, Paul? What does it do?" I believe Paul would answer, "It was power, power that opened my eyes when I was blinded by that heavenly light, power that caused me to lead thousands to the cross of Jesus, power that floated that ship in a storm, that opened those prison doors, that neutralized the poison of that deadly snake." Yes, Paul had talked to God, and God had said to him, "My grace is sufficient for thee." Was it truly sufficient, friends? Follow it through, right down to the very end. Paul never wavered. He was preaching grace the day he died. When he stood before the cruel Roman Emperor Nero, the very last words he uttered, according to the Scriptures, was a plea for others to accept that grace. Yes, friends, that grace of God is the only thing that can hold a man in the face of death. A man can't die for a shallow hope or theory. But Paul counted it joy to lay down his life for Jesus. The miracle-working power of God had made him over. The grace of God had saved him and kept him. Yes, when Jesus looks at a man, it means something. That man's likely never to be the same again. Paul was never the same. Neither was Nathanael, who was under the fig tree, remember. And neither was Zacchaeus after Jesus looked up at him in the sycamore tree. Salvation came home with that rich man that day. Just the day before, Jesus had passed by that same street and looked down in the gutter and saw a poor blind wretch who needed help, and he met that man's need. The next day, he passes by and looks up and sees a rich man in a tree, and he was able to meet his need also. Listen, my friend, Christ can meet your need and mine, whatever it might be. Whatever your problem is, Jesus is a friend who can help. Yes, Peter was never the same after Jesus looked at him by Galilee. But another time Christ looked at Peter. For many days Jesus had been telling his disciples about the terrible trial that waited him in Jerusalem. He told them, for instance, that all men would forsake him. Peter declared that he never would. In fact, he said, though all should forsake you, Lord, I'll never leave you. Of course, Jesus knew better. He said, Peter, before the cock crows thrice, you'll deny me three times. But Peter was in a fighting mood when the mob came to take the master in that early morning. And so he stepped forward with a drawn sword and whacked off the ear of the servant of the high priest. Yes, that day there was more of Peter and less of Christ than there had been before. And then they led the Savior off to the judgment hall of Pilate. Peter followed fearfully at a great distance. But finally he came up and stood before the fire in the courtyard of the judgment hall. He stood there wondering about the proceedings inside. A little maid passed by and said, "You're one of his disciples." And Peter denied it. A second time he was accused and denied. A third time, and his lips gave way to cursing and swearing in his vehement denial. And just at that moment, a door opened and Christ looked out from the hall into the face of his disciple before the fire. And just then, the crowing of the cock was heard. And Peter realized instantly what he had done. His heart was broken. He saw the look of love and pity on the face of Jesus. He went out of that courtyard to fall weeping in the Garden of Gethsemane. Have you ever wondered, friends, why Peter did that terrible thing? How could he take such words on his lips and denying his Lord? I've often wondered just why he did it. He loved Jesus so much, and yet he did it. But listen, don't you love him also? And I love him too, but haven't you asked yourself that question over and over again? Why did I do that? Why did I say this? Oh, yes, we so often do the things that we should not do. But then it's that morning of the resurrection, the break of day. Mary Magdalene has gone to the garden to weep for her Lord. She came in the early gray hours of the first day of the week to anoint him who had delivered her from so much darkness. The glory of God had broken into her life because of the loving ministry of Jesus. But when she came, she found the tomb empty. There was no body of her Lord to be found. And she was weeping her heart out when she heard a familiar voice say, to her, "He's risen, he's not here." And then the word Mary. Were sweeter words ever spoken, friends? And the angel said, "Go your way, tell his disciples and Peter that he goeth before you into Galilee." And she rushed away to call the disciples to come and behold the empty sepulchre. Well, I wish we had more time to talk about the effect it had on those disciples, friends, but our time is gone today. And now, this is Joe Cruz saying goodbye for today. Thank you.